Okay, yeah. Let me welcome everybody. It's to our second series, our lecture series. We have another one coming up on April 27th. Elaine Zimmerman is going to do something on mindfulness, if that's if we all have a mind. Now, let me at this point welcome Rabbi Kurtz to our women's or Women's Agudas group, and we are looking forward to hearing a lot about him. I'm not going to tell you much about him because I've always wanted to say, may I just welcome the speaker today because he needs no introduction. So, Rabbi Kurtz, the place is yours.
Okay, thank you so much, Anna. Thank you for the generous invitation for me to conduct my Monday night class here on a Wednesday afternoon. I see a lot of familiar faces, but some new faces. I mean, I wouldn't even say new. You know, we've all seen each other at shul at some point. So it's good to see you on the screen, I suppose. And, you know, thank you, Lloyd, for keeping me company. I was worried that I'd be the only man. Now I'm still outnumbered, but I'm not quite as outnumbered. So it's very, very considerate of you to join as well. So our topic for this, I shouldn't say evening, for this afternoon, old habits break hard. The topic we're going to talk about is a Torah conception of femininity and masculinity. In particular, the question is as follows. And, I realized that this topic has the potential to become political. I'm going to try to stay apolitical if possible, but I welcome you to think about the implications, and maybe toward the end we could talk about that. But basically, there is no, you know, there's no secret that here in the 21st century, and every year it only becomes more true, that Western society is moving in a direction where gender distinctions and norms are continuously being dissolved. I can see, Ruth, you're in agreement over here. And this is just a fact of the matter. And the interesting question is how the Torah would approach this. In particular, the prism, the lens I want to look through is a prohibition in the Torah called Lo Yilvash. So let me share the screen here, and hopefully this will work. You guys see the screen? Just give me a thumbs up. Okay, great. So, okay, our Monday night folks will recognize a little bit. We did like a preliminary part one, and I said I was going to do multiple parts, and then I never got back to it. So this will be everything in one shot. So we'll be skipping over a few stuff, but you're going to get all the essentials today, God willing. The verse goes as follows. Let me zoom in a little bit, just a little easier on our eyes. Lo yiach li gever al isha. There shall not be a clay gever. We'll just translate right now as a man's garment upon a woman. Lo yilvash gever simlas isha. And nor should a man wear, well, again, we'll just translate as garment for now. A man shall not wear a woman's garment. Why? Ki toavas Adonai lehecho kol se'ela, for it is an abomination. It's abominable to God, anyone who conducts themselves in this manner. Now, what exactly is it? So this seems to be an iser. It's a prohibition. The Torah forbids men to dress as women and women to dress as men. So I'll tell you something really crazy that went on these days. I only discovered this maybe 2 years ago, and hopefully you've never heard of this, but if you did, then you'll know why this is crazy. There's something called a drag queen, which are these men who dress up as women in a promiscuous manner, I might add, and I'm not particularly sure what they do. Thank God I've never actually had to see one of their shows actually live in person or on the computer, but I've read a few articles in the Wall Street Journal and other places to get a sense of what they do. Again, basically men who cross-dress as women, apparently for entertainment purposes, I really don't understand what the entertainment factor is, but apparently there are a lot of people in this world who, for some reason, enjoy that. And our society has gone in a direction where there's even been libraries in the United States of America that during children's reading time, they invite one of these drag queens to do story time with the children. And so this is really the direction. I don't want to say like the entire United States is like, certainly not, but there are certain segments. There are certain segments of culture in the United States and Western society today that celebrate the breakdown of gender norms and gender distinctions. So the question that we want to address is as follows. In a society where gender norms and distinctions are continuously being dissolved to the point that one day there may almost be no meaningful distinction functionally between a man and a woman, what would the Torah say in terms of the issue of cross-dressing? And we'll see in a moment that it's a far more wide-ranging prohibition than just that. So I want to take a look, but I want to take a look at source number two. I'll bring it back on the screen. Source number two. This here is a passage in the Talmud. It is the locus classicus for this sugya, for this discussion. The Talmud wants to address, you know, we have a pasuk, we have a verse in the Torah that says, men and women shall not cross-dress. But the Talmud wants us to understand what are the parameters, what are the details of how wide-ranging or limited this prohibition might be. So it's a dispute between a group of rabbis versus Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. Let me scroll down a little just so you could see the translation, though I will be translating as well. We paskin, we hold like Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. Eliezer ben Yaakov, it says in the Talmud also in Yevamos that Mishas Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Kavanaki, that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, he doesn't take, you know, he wasn't prolific in terms of how many halachic decisions he issued, but we know that on the occasion that he did put his foot down, that he did make his opinion known, we know that he's someone we're supposed to listen to. I remember when I was growing up as a kid in my young Israel back in Far Rockaway, there's a gentleman named Rabbi Bronstein, and he always sat in the back of the shul, a very quiet, very humble, and very knowledgeable fellow. And, you know, he's not the one to complain. He's not the one to raise his voice or to make his opinions heard. But on the rare occasion that he would make his voice heard, we knew that we should at very least give ear and listen to what he has to say. And chances are he's making a very compelling point. You know, there are people in life that, you know, they have an opinion on everything. All right, Shkoyach, you know, you have an opinion on everything. Why should I listen to all of your opinions? But people who are reserved and don't often share opinions, unlike myself, people, I have a lot of opinions. I guess I fall in that category. But people like Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, who are more reserved and choose when to voice themselves on an issue, those kind of people we need to give ear, we need to give more credence to. So Eliezer ben Yaakov, how does he understand the prohibition of cross-dressing? Well, he says, actually, it's not just an issue of cross-dressing, but I would say, I would term it, it's a broader issue of cross-conduct, of men conducting themselves like women, women conducting themselves like men, and dressing is but only one, maybe the most common iteration of it, but it's more far-reaching than just dress. What does he say? How do we know that a woman should not go out with weapons to war? That a man's kalim, his utensils, his items, they should not be upon a woman. So she should not bear arms, not just clothing. She shouldn't even bear weaponry. And what do we do with the verse where it says, a man shall not dress like a woman? That a man should not give himself tikune isha. What's tikune isha? Presumably they translate as cosmetics. A man shouldn't be putting makeup on himself. A man shouldn't be dressing or even conducting himself in a female manner. So I don't quote it here on this sheet. It's from a more comprehensive 2-3 part mini series. But this men are not supposed to look in the mirror, according to the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Now, it doesn't mean not to look in the mirror for a second, probably, but it means to gaze in the mirror. Men are not supposed to. Let me just finish expanding on this idea, and then I'll take your question, Phyllis. So men are not supposed to gaze in the mirror. Why? Because to look in the mirror for a long time and to groom yourself, that is a feminine way of conducting oneself. So I'll just speak for myself without going into any details. In the morning, I just look in the mirror and I quickly throw my hair this way and that way and make sure it's not frizzy everywhere. But my wife, not that she's actually in a rush also, now that we have a kid, she doesn't have the luxury of doing this, but she'd be more likely to take her brush and to do this and that and whatever else. I'm talking to a group of women over here. By the way, I just need to say at this point during this year, I know this is, I'm a man talking to a group of women. Now you might be asking, why did I pick a topic to preach to women about femininity? I was asked to talk about women in Judaism. That's what I was told to talk about. So in case any of you are wondering why I'm talking about that. Okay. Now, Phyllis, you had a question.
Yes. I know that there's many questions about what these laws mean, but how do they get away with, in particular, women going into the army in Israel?
Excellent. And I was waiting for someone to ask that. Thank you, Phyllis. Right. So in the Israeli Defense Forces, there are combat units of women in it. And you know what? This is a very divisive issue within the religious Zionist community in Israel, within the Dati Lumi community. And I'll tell you what, many rabbis there say that women have no business going to the military. That's why they have something called Sheirut Lumi, national service, which women can find other ways to serve and give their time to the state of Israel and to the Jewish people without having to serve in the military. I would add one layer of nuance, by the way. Just because one serves in the military doesn't necessarily mean that they're in a combat unit. There are people who have to do the cleaning, there are people who have to cook the food, there are musicians, apparently, there's a band in the military. So there's many different, there's intelligence units. So there's many kinds of capacities that a person can serve in IDF without necessarily having to be on the front line combat unit. So that would be a way to obviate that issue. Irene, I saw you raising your hand.
How about carrying guns? Served in the military in Israel in intelligence. That's another area that women can serve in that's non-combat.
Exactly. The intelligence unit. It's a perfect example, Irene.
I'm talking about more than them. Just talking about women carrying the guns. They're not supposed to be, according to this, carrying guns.
Okay. So that we need to look back at the actual source. So Phyllis, you point out something very good here. What did Rabbi Lisman Yaakov say? A woman should not go out to war bearing a weapon. But let me ask you, is the issue for women to go out to war, or is the issue for women to bear arms? And I'll give you a nafka mina. I'll give you two practical differences. If the issue is going out to war, but not necessarily bearing weaponry, so maybe serving in the military in general is problematic, even if you're not directly involved in the combat. Nonetheless, we do have sources that talk about how women would provide the food and the rations, the drinks to the men. So definitely they could serve in that capacity, unquestionably. But another good example is, let's say you want to go to the rifle range. You want to go shooting for fun. So is the isser for a woman to bear arms when going out to war? Or is the isser, is the prohibition, has nothing to do with going out to war. That's just most likely when someone's going to use a weapon. But the issue is less about the going out to war, but more about bearing arms by bearing clay Zion. So that's an excellent point. There's a tshuva from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein where he deals with this question. And we might get to that hopefully if we have enough time. So anyway, let me just share a few things very quickly. Just so you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but Purim is coming up. And the issue of cross-dressing actually comes up on Purim as well. How so? Well, I don't know if you saw this last Purim. What was that?
Women dress up as Haman or men dress up as Queen Esther.
Or I'll give you an example. Our beloved youth director is Yaakov Niali. So Yaakov, this past, I was watching in the shul. There was like this woman running around, but like looked very disheveled. And I was trying to figure out like, who is that person over there? And then I saw it was Yaakov wearing a wig. So I'm like, Yaakov just stopped dressed up as a woman? No, what happened was he took Yali, his wife's clothing, and he dressed up as his wife for Purim. That was his shtick. So he was running around with her sheitel. So Yaakov obviously learned the sugya and knows what one is allowed to do. But there's a dispute between the Maharimint and the Bach. The Maharimint says that one is allowed to cross-dress on Purim. Why? Mishum simchas Purim, because it's such a joyous day, and dressing up in different silly ways is permissible. However, the Bach said, no, there's other ways to enjoy Purim. There's many ways to enjoy yourself and to make Purim into a joyous day, but you don't need to violate a Torah prohibition of Yilvash in order to do that. So basically, what's the main principle I want to take from here without getting into too much detail? One only violates the prohibition of cross-dressing when their intention is to do it for the sake of cross-dressing. When I want to beautify myself, when I want to appear like a woman. So that's when I violate the prohibition. But let's say it's happened to me before. It's inclement weather outside. I left my jacket at shul from morning services. It's a Shabbos. And I need to go back for mincha now. So, I left my jacket at shul. What do I do? So, in theory, I could borrow one of Marissa's coats. Only I am much bigger than Marissa, so it doesn't really work out practically. But if I shed a few pounds and I could somehow squeeze Marissa's coat on me, it would be permissible for me to wear my wife's coat. Why? Because I'm not wearing a coat in order to cross-dress. I am wearing the coat to protect myself from the rain. Since I'm doing it for an alternative reason, not for the sake of breaking down the gender norms, not for the sake of appearing like a woman, but for the sake of protecting myself from the elements, that would be permissible. And that's the Ma'ari Mintz's argument for Purim. You're not dressing up as a woman on Purim because you want to trick people that, you know, you want to emulate women. You're doing it as a joke. You're doing it for fun. That should be permissible. And that's basically, you know, even in more yeshivish from circles, especially there, in theory, they could be violating this all the time. Anytime you put on a sketch, you put on a play, since they are single gendered audiences, they're men only or women only audiences. If somebody wants to play the role of the father or the mother, there's someone of the opposite gender is going to be cross dressing. How could they do that? Well, if you're doing it for fun and people know that you're not actually the opposite gender, it's possible it doesn't violate that prohibition. So keep that in mind as we get closer to Purim. Now, this is the real question I want to get to right now. The real question is as follows. Take a look at the Gemara here in Erevin. Perhaps there are certain let me tell you something first. Can the question that appears, can the standards of masculinity and femininity change over time or based on culture? What would you say?
I'd say yes.
I would say yes as well, Phyllis. There's a debate between Rav Avadi Yosef, I think it's the, and I think versus the Chalkis Yaakov, about women wearing pants. So yeah. The question that was sent to Rav Avadi Yosef was that there were young girls who were not dressing modestly. They're wearing I don't even remember what it was. But basically, the question was, is it better to wear pants or to wear a short skirt? And he said, well, there's two issues we have to reckon with. There's the issue of cross-dressing, of lo yilvash, and there's an issue of tznius, of general modesty. So while he said if someone's wearing form-fitting clothing, that could be a problem with general modesty, women wearing pants does not violate lo yilvash. Haraya, you know, you go into Lord and Taylor's, Zichrona Livracha, you go into another store, there would be a men's section of clothing and a women's section, right? There'd be 10.5 floors of women's clothing and then a little shack in the corner somewhere with all the men's clothing, right? So There's clothing, there's pants that are made as men's pants, and there's pants that are made as women's pants. So you can't say, so things do change over time. It's a debate between the Rashba and between the Ran, but that's how most conclude. So let me ask you the question. If nowadays we are getting to a point in society where, you know, let's say that this vocal minority eventually becomes the majority of America, and they wipe out any meaningful distinctions between how men and women dress or conduct themselves, would there basically be no prohibition of lo yilbash anymore? Does that mean there'd be no such thing as violating the issur of cross-dressing? So, Helene, I'll take your question in just a moment, but I'll say there's a tshuva from Rav Moshe Sternbach. Where Rav Moshe Sternbach, he's the head of the Eirach Haaretz HaYisrael. You know, you want to think right wing, he's as right wing as they come. So Rav Moshe Sternbach received a question, can women smoke? Now, mind you, in a later tshuva, he points out that nobody should be smoking due to the health risks. But this was a response that he wrote, I think, to earlier in his career. So nobody was clear on the health risks at that point when he wrote it. And he said, women should not be smoking. Why? Because that's a masculine thing to do. Men smoke, not women. You'll see some women that smoke. He says, well, those are either secular women or non-Jewish women. But he says the tznuos, the modest women, you'll not find any of them smoking anywhere. And so without getting too lost in the case, which is amusing, the point he's making is that even if the standards, even if the application of lo yilvash can change, even if something that's considered feminine one time can be masculine another time. Another example given is it used to be prohibited for men to shave their armpit hair and genital hair, but now, you know, but over time, in some societies, it was the norm for men to shave themselves in those areas. So many, many medieval scholars believe that could change over time. So Rav Moshe Sternbach says, yes, change can happen, but who do we look for to determine what is considered legitimate change? And he says, we're not looking at the licentious, the more promiscuous elements of society. They don't get to determine what the norm is that the Torah uses, but we look at people where we generally know are God-fearing, modest, you know, upstanding people of integrity. And, you know, if there's a new trend that women start wearing pants, then, you know, and you see people who we know are modest, God-fearing people, and they do that. So, okay, then maybe that's an acceptable trend as long as it's done in a tsinua way. But nowadays, and I don't want to get into too much detail, some of the changes that we're seeing in society are not being propounded by the most God-fearing elements of society, but from those who would say that the sexual norms of the Torah have no bearing on their lives. And I won't elaborate on that, but I think you can figure out what I mean. So perhaps even if certain things can change based on time, based on context, it doesn't mean every change by any person or group gets to determine a legitimate change through the lens of the Torah. And with that, Helene, thank you for waiting so patiently. You can unmute yourself and would love to hear what's on your mind. See if you have it. Or did you accidentally raise your hand? I'm not sure.
Rabbi.
Okay. I'll take Audrey your point. Hopefully, Helene, you'll figure out how to.
Everything you're just describing and going back in history, Rabbi, is all external. You know, my thoughts are always what is going inside the internal. You know, everything is on the surface, and that's what everyone's making judgments and making decisions. But it's really what is happening internally, and that more determines the person who they are.
Right.
And what, you know, putting on a different outfit or makeup or all that, you know, that's a temporary thing, but internally,
what is internal?
So Aline, I think what you're saying,
what people are thinking, what their emotions are,
right?
What goes back to their trauma, their early childhood. There's so much even though people manifest it maybe with certain expression, makeup, dress, this, that. That's where it all stems from.
Yeah.
In my way of thinking.
Right. So Helene, you raise an important point, which is, you know, certain things in the Torah, it doesn't matter what you're thinking at the time. You know, if you kill someone, God forbid, you kill them regardless of what your intent is. But here, what's interesting about this prohibition of cross-dressing is that there seems to be a subjective element that we take into account. Like we said before, if I'm wearing my wife's jacket so I can look like a woman, that's a problem. If I wear my wife's jacket to protect myself from the rain, then that would be permissible. So there is a subjective element. But what's interesting, actually, and I think, Helene, this is a good segue to the next part I want to point out, is that there might be certain things that are objectively masculine in nature. Again, I don't want to get into too much detail because I know we're already under half an hour, but one such example would be tefillin. So it says in the Gemara in Erevin that Michal Bas Kushi, so Michal, the daughter of Shol HaMelech, King Saul, she would wear tefillin and the rabbis did not protest her. So just note the language here, v'lo michu b'chachamim. You know, it's like people all the time I see are violating things in the Torah, but I don't always speak up every time because I know, they might not listen to me. For instance, I know I'm going to get in a lot of trouble when I say this right now. There's a prohibition in Torah called losikrevu legalis erva, that one should not come to unveil one's nakedness. So why say losikrevu? You shouldn't even come close. So the understanding is, even if one is not having, you know, direct sexual relations with someone who's forbidden to them, like someone else's spouse, to even come close, to even hug or kiss, that already, affectionate touch is already problematic. So I know that there's like a norm in some circles where, a guy will go over to someone else's wife and, like the Godfather style, give a kiss on one cheek and then the other. But actually, from a Torah perspective, that's prohibited. Now, I've seen people do that in the past. I didn't say anything afterwards because I thought they wouldn't like to hear that. And they probably just get upset at me rather than listen to me quoting the Torah. But this is an important thing. Just because the rabbis didn't protest her for wearing tefillin doesn't mean they necessarily approved either. They may have just been afraid of reprisal from her father, who was the king. You know, the king would say, who are these rabbis criticizing my daughter? Off with their heads. So just because they didn't speak up doesn't mean they necessarily approved. But nonetheless, why was she allowed to wear tefillin if we assume that's the case? Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, Rav Hankin, these are all 20th century Rabbanim. They say, because what was her intent when wearing tefillin? She wasn't trying to wear tefillin because that's what men wear, but she was wearing tefillin because she wanted to do it l'shem mitzvah, to perform a mitzvah. So his argument is the same way I can wear my wife's jacket to protect myself from the rain. I'm not trying to look like a woman. I'm not trying to emulate femininity. So too, Michal was not emulating masculinity by wearing tefillin. She just wanted to perform a mitzvah. So that's why it was perhaps permissible for her. Nonetheless, very fascinating. Just one moment. Very fascinating. If you look in source 8 here at Targum Yonas ben Uziel, which pseudo Jonathan, which is an Aramaic translation of the verse. Now, I use the term translation loosely. Many times the translation is not just a straight verbatim translation, but he'll add in some in between the line commentary. So I didn't put in the source here. Okay, I didn't put in the, oh no, here it is. So lo yegluin de tzitzis utfila dinu tekune gever al isisa. What should a woman not wear? All it says in the Hebrew, in the Bible, is that a woman should not have clay gever, men's clothing, men's items. But what does Targum Yonas ben Uziel add in here? A woman should not wear tzitzis and tefillin. Wow, he singles out tzitzis and tefillin to make the argument that there might be certain things that are fundamentally gendered in nature and perhaps actually don't change over time. And if you assume it's the same author, Targum Yonas ben Uziel, in the book of Judges in Shoftim, we read about this in Haftorah recently, for those who are keeping score. I shortened the Saptorah actually when I laid it in the sanctuary unwittingly. So Yael, who kills Sisera, the general, instead of using a sword, she uses a tent peg. If he's a general, wouldn't he have a sword on him? Couldn't she just use his sword to kill him? He was asleep. Why does she have to use a tent peg? So the reason is, because she didn't want to violate the prohibition of bearing weaponry, which also is arguably fundamentally a masculine thing to do, is to use weaponry. So I don't want to get too much into it, but it's possible there are certain things that even as far as time changes, they remain gendered inherently by the Torah. So those are a few things just to bear in mind, but we don't have time to elaborate on it too far. The final thing I want to ask you is as follows. And I'm just going to ask, I'll take all questions at the end. I just want to make sure we get through all the material. Well, I guess, but you can answer this question that I'll share. What's so bad? You know, there's a sitcom that Marissa was watching. I forgot which one, but I was in the room and I was watching with her a little bit, where one of the characters in the TV show, he is asked by one of his female friends to hold her pocketbook for a little bit. And then he starts walking around with the pocketbook. He's like, oh, this is like really useful. I could keep my phone in here. I could keep my pens in here. I could keep my wallet in here. He's like, why don't men walk around with pocketbooks? This is like amazing. You have this like thing here that is everything, your notepads, everything you need could just fit inside this pocketbook. Well, why haven't men figured this out? So he starts walking around and everyone's like staring at him, like, what's wrong with this guy? But he really loved wearing a pocketbook. So, you know, what's so bad? If I want to wear a pocketbook, what's so bad about that? What's so bad if, you know, if I like skirts and we're not in Scotland and where they wear kilts, if I enjoy wearing a skirt, if I feel it's fashionable, I enjoy that. What's wrong with Moshe Kurtz wearing a skirt? So fundamentally, we've been talking about the halakhic, the legal parameters, but let's take a step back. What is so bad? Why does God care if I cross-dress? What's going to happen? What's the big deal? What do we think, guys? What's the big deal? Why should I not be allowed to cross-dress? Audrey.
Robbie, looking at pictures, paintings, in books, on walls, the men of yesteryear were wearing what I would call a shmata, a robe, looks like a robe. They're not wearing, I don't know, one of these days I'm going to remember to Google when pants came into style for men.
Right.
But they're wearing these robes. Women are wearing the same kind of robes in these depictions of yesteryear. So there's no difference there. And also, men's clothing now and women's clothing, the buttons are on different sides.
Yes.
When you buy a men's shirt or a women's shirt, the buttons and buttonholes are on different sides. I'm really not sure if the flies on pants, like dungarees have zippers on women's pants. I'm not sure if that's different. I've really never investigated that. But that's a difference. And if you're going to wear your wife's jacket to be protected from the weather, I want to wear pants to protect my legs from the winter. So what's so terrible about that?
Right. And I would agree. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong. Women actually started wearing pants, possibly because of menstrual concerns. It was easier. So it's an excellent point.
There's no question. And also sitting in general, so that we don't excite you with men. If you happen to look at the women's section in shul and there isn't a divide or from the balcony and up, if we sit in a skirt that's not down to the floor, so then our knees are exposed and our skin is exposed. So it's a distraction for you men who, God forbid, you might get a sexual desire just looking. So why can't I be protected? Why do we have to protect the men all the time? So there.
I should have been careful coming
to the Yay, Audrey.
Person who very rarely talks up
during classes is all of a sudden opening up.
Because you know the men are outnumbered here.
By the way, Rabbi, men have this thing called a men's purse.
Yes.
There are special kind of purses now for men.
Right. And many briefcases.
Yeah.
Men carry them for years.
Yeah. And the Kohen Gadol, he wore pants and he wore a mihil, I guess it was, that he wore, yeah, which looked like a robe of some sort. And he wore a fancy a breastplate, like women's jewelry, you might say, of today.
Right. That's right.
Right.
And I think all the examples you guys are giving are great examples of things that have become accepted, have crossed gendered lines. But that's because once there are, I guess, men's purses being made and they're marketed as men's purses, they're not female clothing because they are made for men. That's the idea.
Is that rabbinic? Is that permitted in the ultra or in the?
Well, you know what's funny? I think Hasidim on their bekeshas, on their long coats, they actually button it the same way as women do, to the other side. I have my buttons on my right, and it goes into the left. But women, you said, is the opposite, right?
Yes.
So I think Hasidim actually have that on their on their bekeshes.
What really depicts what is happening today and what has made, as far as I'm concerned, the change is that women are as educated as men. That was a big, big step. You could talk about this outfit, all the other external things, but man has to validate women more so than they ever did from early on. And to some, I think it even, if I have to be honest, poses a threat. Because women are now moving up, they are into the similar professions.
Yes.
They offer, they contribute. So to me, that was the biggest change.
Right, education.
If you think back in biblical times to now, that women are on the same intellectual and personal level.
And you know, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I'm sure we've heard the name at some point. Who's the founder of modern orthodoxy here in America. So that was his rationale for why he was so adamant about teaching women Talmud, teaching women Gemara. Because he said it's a shanda that all these women, they're getting their doctorates, they're getting all these degrees, they're learning sciences and literature on the highest of levels. And what, they should know Torah on the level of a fifth grader? That's absurd. And so that's why he made such a big push for women to study Talmud. And by the way, that's why I make such a big push. That's why we have our weekly, if you guys don't know about it yet, I know many of you are on it already. We have a weekly Talmud class on Thursday nights. All right. I mean, obviously each and every individual needs to figure out what works for them. But that's a huge point. I mean, that speaks to your point, Aline, that education, thank God, has become more available today, not just to men, but to women as well. It's become more democratized. And so if one is spending so much time studying all these secular subjects, why not study God's Torah on at least with the equal amount of dedication and level of sophistication? So
doesn't it say that the mother is supposed to teach the children?
Mm-hmm. That was also part of the argument. You know, if she's the one at home who's giving all this education and transmitting Torah values to the children, you would think the more Torah you know, the more informed you'll be to give that to your children, to inculcate that with them. Exactly.
Right. And help them with their homework.
Yeah, exactly. Or any just transmitting our tradition. The more you know about our tradition, the better you can do transmitting the tradition. So.
I'm still writing term papers. It doesn't stop.
Anyway, I want to get to the conclusion here. So I asked the question, why is it that, what's the issue of cross-dressing? So there are two issues identified traditionally in a Sefer HaChinuch and a Sefer HaMitzvos. These are books that count up all 613 mitzvos and give a brief overview of their parameters, and the reasons behind them. So there are two rationales offered. One is, Pamim Teaseh Lo'or HaTeva LeZima. One concern is, and this is brought up in the Gemara, is that if, let's say, a man will dress up as a woman, he'll use that as an excuse to slip into the sisterhood meeting and who knows, wreak havoc or something like that. I'm just joking, Lloyd. I'm just messing. Let's say you're having like the Beis Yaakov dinner and this guy dresses up as a woman, or you have like a yentl, a woman who dresses up as a man. And it could lead to licentiousness by breaking into these single sex gatherings. That's issue number one. The second rationale is that it's me'avodas avodah zarah. If you look at Rambam in Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, the Mor Nevuchim, he says that when they worshiped the planets back then, was it Venus and Uranus, it was something, or Mars, so they would cross-dress to do it. For some reason, cross-dressing was a part of idolatrous services. You'll see that in Eastern religions today as well. Marissa and I are watching a documentary. This priestess, every time she calls a new spirit, she dresses like the spirit that they imagine. So that involves her cross-dressing as a man many of times. However, so those are the two common reasons that are given. But let me ask you again. Remember our good friend, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov? Let's take a look back for a second. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said that a woman should not go out to war bearing arms. Now, let me ask you, are we afraid if a woman carries a rifle, it's going to lead to licentiousness? Are we afraid that if a woman bears arms or a man wears cosmetics, it's going to lead to avodah zarah, especially today? Is anyone here tempted to cross-dress for the sake of worshiping pagan gods? So no, none of these reasons seem very compelling to us based on what we're seeing today. However, there's a third reason given that many people overlook, but I think speaks the best to our current circumstances where we find ourselves here in the 21st century in Western society. The Ibn Ezra, one of the commentaries, one of the medieval commentaries on the verse, says, why is it that men are not supposed to dress like women and women should not be like men? So I have to issue what they call it in my generation. I think I'm a millennial. I think I am. So we invented a term called a trigger warning, which is to warn you that you're about to hear something you might not like, and you could mute me for the rest of this year if you want, because if you don't like hearing traditional gender distinctions, this is your warning, because you're about to hear a lot of it. So I'll give you all 5 seconds to mute me if you need to find the button. And then afterwards, if you don't mute me, then it's on you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, Audrey, Helene, I'm just saying you're not going to like this. And anyone else who was in agreement with them. The manager says, "What nismach avor tseis l'machamak yet?" So why is the prohibition of cross-dressing juxtaposed to the mitzvah of going out to war? To teach us that a woman shouldn't be going out to war. Rather, lo nivrei skim lahakim azara. Their job is to raise the children. And a huge ellipsis, many words later, he concludes by saying, and anyone who breaks the gender norms, Hashem yidav misha yishana maisa Hashem. Why does God not want men to dress like women, to act like men? Why? Because God abominates anyone who changes his vision for the world. The Maisa Hashem. What does that mean? Abarbanel, another medieval commentary, a little later, he says, Ki Adam Roy Shianikar Banu Shosa Va Ishiv Nekivusa. A man should be recognized in his manliness and a woman in her womanliness, in her femininity. And therefore, why is it that this isser, this prohibition of cross-dressing, is juxtaposed to the mitzvah of carrying a load for someone who needs help? To teach men, that men shouldn't be dainty, but rather let them gird their loins and, help somebody out. Same idea as Ibn Ezra, that men are supposed to be men, women are supposed to be women, and that should not be changing. And if you don't want to hear from them, I'll give you a few more sources to drive the point home. Rabin Bechaye on why men are not allowed to get rid of their beards, which I guess I keep only half of that halacha. No, I'm joking. I don't use a razor, so therefore I'm keeping it. But why is it that men are supposed to have facial hair? Kedei lahavdilo mimin hanakeva, to distinguish them from their female counterparts, so that men are men, women are women. Why? Because it's about maintaining the integrity of Maisa Bereishis, of how God created the world. There's a story in the Gemara, Maseches Shabbos. Let's just see how much time we have left. Okay, good. We'll finish this by 2:30. There's a story in Maseches Shabbos. This is a wild one. Tana Rabbanan, Maisa Be'echashim Mesa Ishto Benicha Ben Ninak L'Hoylo Schar Menicha Litain. So there's a story where, unfortunately, a man had lost his wife and she left him a child in this world, and he couldn't afford a wet nurse, and he hadn't. There was no formula for him to give to his child. And God performed a miracle and gave him breasts like a woman so that he could nurse his child. Crazy, right? So how would you react? Well, there's two reactions in the Gemara. Amar Rav Yosef, oh, look how amazing this man must be, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that God changed the course of nature to give him the ability to feed his child. Amarle Abaye, Abaye responds, Adarabba, on the contrary, Kama Gorua Adam Zeshin Ishalo Siddur Rages, how lowly is this man that God changed the natural order of this world to accommodate his needs. And the Maharal explains that, what does this mean? What does the Gemara mean? That God created Mais Bereishis, and God created certain norms for this world that he does not want to break. And one of those norms that God created into the very fabric of this world is the nature of men and the nature of women as being two distinct units. Take a look over here. And lest you say, oh, these are all medieval rabbis. Well, take a look at Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. He's pretty recent. Late 19th, early 20th century, I believe. Rav Shimson Raphael Hirsch. And he was known as a pretty modern guy for his time, you know, a very posh rabbi in Germany at the time. So very, what you would call modern Orthodox today. He says, what is the reason why God forbids cross-dressing? He says that a man is not to prink and this is a weird translation. I think it was written in German originally, but this is how it was translated into English in the Rabbi Hirsch Chumashim, which we have a set or two at our shul. That a man is not to prink and prank himself in an effeminate manner. It seems to us as clear that according to the way of taking it, the prohibition is not so much disguising one's sex by dressing in female clothes as forbidding each sex that which is more specifically pertaining to the nature of the opposite one. A man is just as little to get himself up with powder and paint and lipstick, which is all quite in order for a woman to do, and it's in accordance with feminine nature as a woman is to appear in a profession which belongs to the nature of men. So, Helene, to your point over there. But the point I want to take away from all this is, in the first part of our class, we talked about how the prohibition of cross-dressing, cross-conduct, there's a lot of leeway. There's a lot of leniency. Most things, if you're not intending to do it for the sake of cross-dressing, it's okay. And even the things that, you know, might be considered cross-dressing in one time, if you go from one culture to another culture in a different time in history, the definition of what's masculine and feminine can change over time. And you know what? I would say we can adopt a very liberal position on this, that women's clothing is what society calls women's clothing. Men's clothing is what's considered men's clothing. But what's the issue that's going on in society today? The debate has shifted. The debate is no longer figuring out and parsing, are pants for women alone, for men? Is it for women also? Can a man have a man purse? It's no longer about the details. It's that there are people who fundamentally want to deny and want to dissolve any meaningful difference between men and women. We could talk about the details. We can talk about the parameters. We can talk about what things change at what time, fine. But what's perfectly clear, what's unequivocally clear from these commentaries from the Torah is that there's supposed to be something called men, which do men things, and there's supposed to be women, which do womanly things. Does that mean that a man needs to be a muscle builder or a woman needs to walk around with in pink shirts all the time? That's not necessarily what it means. I don't think that's what the Torah is saying. You know, a man, I think it used to be that men are not allowed to show emotion. Today, that's changed society. Men are allowed to show emotion publicly. Or it was more looked down, like you're less manly if you show emotion and if you shed a tear. That's changed a bit in society. You know, I think that's a positive. I think men should be allowed to show emotion. Now, so there are some positive changes. But there's one thing that everybody, no matter how conservative or liberal you are on this Isser of Lo Yilvash, everyone needs to agree that there's something called men, something called women. We can talk about the details of where the lines are of distinction between the genders, but we at least have to acknowledge there's something called men, something called women, and that's how God created the world, and that's how God intends it to be. I'll leave off with just one last story. There's a medrash in which a Roman philosopher, Turnus Rufus, he challenged the great sage Rabbi Akiva to a philosophical debate. One of the questions he raised was, why is it that baby boys are born pre-circumcised? I would think if God is perfect, let him create baby boys circumcised already. You know, Hashem can do, if your God is so great, why can he do that? Why do you have to make you do it? So Rabbi Akiva answered that God gave the mitzvos to us, letzarif es abrios. God gave us mitzvos to refine us so that we could partner with God on making this a better world. God set for us a foundation. God set for us a vision for this world. And it's incumbent upon us now to partner with Hashem, not by, God forbid, tearing down that foundation that he gave us, but by building on that foundation. And by doing so, may we all be able to partner with God in our lives for all the days of our lives. So I will conclude over here. I'm happy to stay on and take questions, but it's 2:29, so I finished a minute early. I want to thank you all for your time this afternoon. It's been really wonderful learning with all of you, hearing your insights and questions. And we should do it again sometime.
These rabbis are probably turning over in their grave. They were talking about cross-dressing. They didn't know anything about the transgender thing that's going on today in the world, which
I think a lot of sources we learned could inform the question of transgender identity. I purposely didn't go down that route because honestly, the question of transgenderism really is deserving of its own separate shir, because there's a great shul since Leizer that talks about gender reassignment surgery, and there's actually a debate. Not that one's allowed to do, but if one post facto undergoes a sex reassignment surgery, if it actually is recognized by halacha. So we can talk about that another time, but I'll have to leave that for another shir.
What about women going to work?
Work in general?
You know, I'm supposed to stay home and take care of the babies.
Yes, you want to know what's so funny about it? To a certain degree, the yeshivish world, the Haredi world, is the most progressive on this. Because what happens? All the men learn in kollel all day, so they expect their wives to go out and work. Now, what they would say, by the way, what they would say back is that there's different kinds of professions. You'll see that most of them wind up becoming teachers, become like an OT, a PT, jobs that enable one to raise a family. You know, I mean, not to say my wife is more liberal than I am, which isn't saying much because I'm not so liberal. But Marissa's a speech therapist. She didn't become a speech therapist because she's like, women only belong in the speech therapy field. She just happened to pick that and happens to be, it's really good because she gets home at 3:00. So, you know, we could swap the baby. I could pick up the baby from daycare, which actually I need to do very soon to pick her up at 3:00. And then she grabs her and I could go to the shul for mincha and do my evening shiurim. So the issue wouldn't be women in the workforce per se at this point. But I think the debate you'll see within the Orthodox world is if all professions are considered appropriate. In the modern Orthodox world, honestly, you don't even see people debating this. So that's considered anathema to modern Orthodoxy to even debate that. But it's an excellent point that you raise. I would say the military.
And when do they,
Yeah.
Yeah, you associate guns with military. What about women who are at home and have guns to protect the family?
Very good.
I mean, I know a lot of Israeli women and a lot of American women.
Very good.
Carry guns.
Excellent point, Audrey. So there are two tshuvas. We didn't go through them. One by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was the primary rabbinic authority of America in the late 20th century, and Rabbi Avadi Yosef, his Sephardic counterpart in Israel. And they both address the same question. Moshe Feinstein was talking about women living in the settlements, in the shtachim, and if they want to leave their yeshuv, they want to leave their settlement, they want to know that they're not going to be killed by terrorists. So can they bear arms?
Right.
Moshe Feinstein has a whole lengthy tshuva in which he says that there might be a difference since they're not going out to war. There's a difference maybe between an assault rifle, a military grade rifle, versus something like a pistol, which could arguably be more for self-defense. That's a distinction he makes. Rav Avadi Yosef's case is about women who are moras at a school. They're teachers at a school.
Right.
There's a debate in America today.
Right.
Should we be arming our teachers? And there's a legitimate debate to have about that. So there in Israel, it wasn't a debate. It was an obvious course of action. And so Rav Avadi Yosef said, look, this is pikuach nefesh. People's lives are on the line. And that would supersede lo yilvash, just like it would supersede anything, almost anything in the Torah. Very
Rabbi, the bottom line is there's always a back door or another road.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But that's the point I wanted to make.
It just takes time.
yeah, well... maybe in some religions, but that's the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that there's built-in flexibility to these laws. But fundamentally, the moment that you say that the notion of there being something called men and women is problematic, is offensive, is against our beliefs, you've gone against Torah beliefs.
No, that's the point I want to make.
There's always room for machlokes and disagreement, but there's always a red line somewhere, which is there's always debate within the purview of the Torah. But it's once you go outside of that purview, that's when it becomes problematic. Okay. So wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all for your time.
Thank you so much. Very good.
Thank you, Anne, for organizing it again. Take care.